This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
And it's wonderful to have John Waters join us once again from Ireland. John, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you on. It was ages ago, goodness, talking about immigration. That was a good 18 months ago. So always good to have you on. And people can follow you, obviously, your Substack, johnwaters.substack.com. And that's where they can get all your writings. And you've got one of your latest ones, I think, Beware the Ides of March, Part 1. Do you just want to mention that to give people a flavor of what they can find on your Substack?
Yeah, it's a short series. I don't know. I think it's going to be probably two, maybe three articles. I have several other things that are kind of related to it, but it's really the story of what happened, what has been happening since 4 years ago, you know, really, as opposed to what they told us, what happened, what we've been talking about. It's essentially, you know, this was not about your health. It was about your wealth, essentially, and that's the message. So I go through that in terms of its meanings and so on. And in the first part, which has just gone up last night. And it's really about, you know, the way that the predator class, the richest of the rich in the world, are essentially coming to the end of their three-card trick, which has been going on now for 50 years, which is the fiat money systems that emerge after the untethering of currencies from the gold standard. And that's essentially been a balloon that's been expanding, and it's about to blow. They're trying to control that explosion. But essentially, their mission is to ensure that, you know, not a drop of their wealth is spilt in whatever happens, right? Well, and that everybody else will lose everything, pretty much. They don't care about that. In fact, that's part of their wish. And so it's that really, that's what I'm kind of talking about and how that started. Because really, you know, we now know that the beginnings of what is called COVID were nothing to do with a virus. There were a bulletin issued by BlackRock on the 15th of August 2019, Assumption Day in the Christian calendar, which is the day that the body of our Blessed Virgin was received into heaven. But the word assumption has lots of other meanings, and I think there was a lot of that at play on that particular day when they were assuming the right to dictate to the world what its future should be. And that was really the start of it. And the COVID lockdowns and all of that flowed inexorably. There's a lot of stuff we could go into, but we won't, I don't think, about vaccines and all the rest of it. They're part of that story, but the central part was that this was completely fabricated and completely engineered. And it was a fundamental attack on human freedom in the West particularly, and has been largely successful so far. But now, as I think we're going to talk about, even in Ireland, there's beginning to be that little bit of a pushback. So I'm hopeful now.
Well, obviously, I've really enjoyed your writings on Substack. I don't have the patience for the writing, but you are a writer, a journalist, and that is your bread and butter. And people obviously can support you financially on the Substack if they want to do that after reading your writings. But let's into Ireland. We saw this referendum, and it's interesting. We'll get into some of the comments on it, but really there were two parts of this referendum, and it was focusing really on family and the woman's position or the mother's position. Do you want to just let us know how this referendum came about?
Okay, well, first of all, you got to see it in its context, which is in a series of attacks on the Irish Constitution going back, well, going back, you could say 30 years. It depends in the context of the European Union and the various referendums that we had about that, the Nice Treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, in which the Irish people were basically told when they voted no, they were told that's the wrong answer. You're going to have to think again and you're going to have to vote again. And they did, and it passed because they were just bullied into doing it. So then in the past decade, or so, a dozen years, we've had three critical referendums which attacked, you know, the Irish Constitution has a series of fundamental rights articles right in the center of it. articles 40 to 44. And that's been informally called by judges over the years the Irish Bill of Rights, which is all the personal fundamental rights, all the rights that derive essentially from natural law in the greater number of them. That, in other words, they're inalienable, imprescriptible, they are antecedent, they're not generated by the Constitution or indeed by the people, but certainly not by the government or anybody else. There was an attack on the Article 41 in 2012, which was purportedly to put in children's rights into the Constitution. That was completely bogus because it was a successful attempt to transfer parental rights to the state. That's what it was when you look closely at it. And I was fighting all these referendums. Then in 2015, we had the so-called gay marriage or the marriage referendum, which essentially, you know, people don't really get this. They talk about Ireland having, you know, legalized gay marriage. No, we didn't. That's not what we did. We actually destroyed marriage by putting gay marriage as an equivalent concept in our constitution. And then there was the infamous Eighth Amendment referendum in 2018, which was essentially to take out an amendment which had been put in some 40 years before, 30 years before, in 1983, to guarantee, to, as it were, copper fasten the right to life of the unborn child. And there's a very subtle point that needs to be made about this. Not very subtle, really, but legally it is, which is that this was an unlawful referendum, because this was one of those inalienable, imprescriptible rights. Even though the article in which it was couched was only introduced in 1983, all it was a kind of a reminder that these rights exist, because these rights already exist as unenumerated rights. And as a result of that, the referendum was actually unlawful and should never have taken place, because the Irish people had no right to vote down the rights of a section of its own population, which was the unborn children, waiting to emerge into the world, to live their lives in peace and whatever would come their way in that life. But nevertheless, to have essentially an illegal, unlawful law, quote unquote, created that prevented them from even entering this world, it seemed to me to be the greatest abomination that has ever happened in our country. So this was a continuation of this. There are different theories about what it was about, because there were two amendments, as you said, Peter. The second one that you mentioned was the mother in the home. And this was a guarantee to women, to mothers, that they would be protected from having to go out, if they wished, to go out into the workplace and work. And if they wanted to mind their children, then the state would take care of them. It's not specific, but nevertheless, it placed on the state a burden of responsibility to give women this choice. Now, of course, the government and its allies, its proxies, try to say it's really an attack on women, that is, you know, it saves their places in the home. This kind of caricaturing of the wording and so on. In fact, it's nonsense, because there's another article, Article 45, which explicitly mentions the right of women to have occupations in the public domain and to go and work and earn a living for themselves. So this was a complete caricature. And I think people understood that. The other one then was a redefinition of the family, which is Article 41 again. All of this is 41, which defines the family always has as being based on marriage. And, you know, that has been the source of some dissension over the years, some controversy, because, you know, more and more families were outside marriage, as it were. They were small F families, as it were, rather than a big F family as arises in the Constitution. And they claimed to be sorting this out, but of course they weren't sorting it out at all. When you actually catalogued the various categories of family who might theoretically benefit from such a change, none of them were benefiting at all. I went through this microscopically in the course of the campaign several times on videos and so on. So really what it was really to leverage the progressive vote, I think. That was one object to get people excited again, as they were getting nostalgic for 2015 and 2018 because they were becoming more and more popular. That was certainly one aspect. But there were other aspects, which is that they were introducing into the Constitution, or supposing that along with marriage, that also would be included something called durable relationships. Mm. And they refused or were unable to define what this meant. And the result of it is that there were all kinds of proposals and suggestions that it might well mean, for example, polygamy. That it might mean the word appear durable appears in European law in the context of immigration. And there was a very strong suspicion, which the government was unable to convincingly deny, that this was a measure that they needed to bring in order to make way for what they call family reunification. So that if one person gets into Ireland, they can then apply to have their entire families brought in after them. That's already happening, by the way, without this. They say that something like an average of 20 people will follow anybody who gets in and gets citizenship of Ireland. They bring something like an average of 20 people with them afterwards. So this was another aspect of it. There were many, many theories posited about it. But one thing for sure was that the government was lying literally every day about it, trying to present this progressive veneer. And more, what was really, really, I think, staggering in the end, in a certain sense, was that the people not alone saw it in a marginal way, they saw it in an overwhelming way. This was the start. I mean, I don't think a single person, myself included, predicted that we would have a 70-30 or whatever it was, roughly, 3-1 result for no. I mean, that was really miraculous. And I've said to people that it was actually a kind of a loaves and fishes vote, you know, that it was greater than the sum of all its parts, greater than anything that we thought was possible. And it was like a miracle that all of the votes just keep tumbling out. No, 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 no. And I've been saying that no actually represents much more than what it might technically read as a response to the wording that was on the ballot paper. That it was really, I think, the expression of something that we hadn't even suspected was there. Because for 4 years now, the Irish people have labored under this tyranny of you know, really abuse of power by the government, by the police force, by the courts. And a real tyranny that is really, I think, looks like it's getting its feet under the table for quite a long haul. Accompanied by that, there was what I call this concept, this climate of mutism, whereby people weren't able any longer to discuss certain things in public for fear that they would get into trouble. You know, that because this was very frequently happening. You know, I mean, since the marriage referendum of 2015, before that, for about a year, the LGBT goons went on the streets and ensure that everybody got the message that we weren't allowed to talk about things that they had an interest in. And anybody who did was absolutely eviscerated, myself included, and was cancelled or demonised or whatever, you know. And that has had a huge effect on Irish culture, a culture that used to be very argumentative and garrulous, has now become almost paranoid, you know, and kind of, you have this kind of culture of humming and hawing. If you get involved in a conversation with somebody and you say something that is even maybe two or three steps removed from a controversial issue, they will immediately know it and clam up, you know, and this has been happening now in our culture right across the country. And when you think about it, I've been saying in the last week that actually, for all its limitations, the polling booth, that corner of the room in which the votes are being cast, with the little table and the pencil and the, you know, a little bit of a curtain in some instances, but even not, there's a kind of a metaphorical curtain. And that became the one place in Ireland that you could overcome your mutism, that you could put your mark on that paper and make your and do it convincingly and in, you know, in a firm hand. And I think that's really the meaning of it, that it was a no, 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 no to just about everything that this government and its proxies have been trying to push over on Ireland for the last few years, including the mass immigration, essential replacement of the Irish population, including the vaccines, which really have killed now in Ireland something like 20,000 people over the past 3 years. And, you know, that's, you know, I would say a conservative enough estimate, not to mention the injuries of people that, you know, a lot, the many people who are ill now as a result of this. And then, of course, we have the utterly corrupt media refusing to discuss any of this and to put out all kinds of misdirection concerning.
There was an interesting line in one of the articles on this, and it said the scale of rejection spelled humiliation for the government, but also opposition parties and advocacy groups who had united to support a yes, yes vote. And tell us about that. I mean, how does it's not just the government? Well, the government is made up, obviously, of the three parties, the unholy alliance. Fine Gael, Fine Gael, and sorry, what was the other?
The Green Party.
The Greens.
Well, the Green Party are a fairly traditional element in Irish politics, not so much in the ideology, but in the idea of the small party, because they're the tail that wags the dog. They have all the ideological ideas. I mean, the main parties have virtually no ideology whatsoever. Like, they've been just catch-all parties for a century or whatever their existence has been. But that idea, you see, what we've noticed increasingly over the last, say, 10, 15 years, particularly, I think, since 2011, we had an election that year, which I think was a critical moment in Irish life, when, in fact, everything seemed to change. We didn't notice it at the time, but moving on from that, it became clear that something radical had happened in the very, and the ruins of Irish culture, as it were, both spellings, actually. As we moved out from that, it became clear that really there was no opposition anymore, that all the parties were just different shades or different functions within a singular ideology. Like, the so-called left parties were, it's not that they would be stating the thing, they would sort of, they would become almost like the military wing of the mainstream parties, enforcing their diktats on the streets. Like, if people went to protest about something outside the Houses of Parliament, the Leinster House, these key people would up and mount a counter protest against them and call them all kinds of names like Nazis and white supremacists, all this nonsense, which has no place in Irish culture whatsoever. And so it is a kind of a uniparty, as they say, as is the recent term for it. But my own belief is that actually this is a somewhat distraction, in the sense that we shouldn't anymore be looking at individual parties, because in fact all of them are captured from outside, and the World Economic Forum is basically dictating pretty much everything that everybody thinks now. I mean, our so-called Taoiseach, God help us, I hate to call him that, because it's an honourable title, it's a sacred title to me, and to have this appalling creep going swaggering around claiming that title for himself, it seems it's one of the great obscenities of modern Ireland. But he is a member of the World Economic Forum. So is Martin, the leader of Fianna Fáil, they've been switching over the Taoiseach role for the last 4 years.
Because that's quite strange. I mean, many of our viewers will not be from Ireland and will be surprised at the confusion system you have, where they just swap every so often because the three of them are in cahoots.
That's a completely new thing. Okay. That's never happened before. But what it's about, you see, those two parties are the Civil War parties.
Yeah.
Civil War back in 1922. Those parties grew out of it, and they became almost equivalent in popularity. They represent in some ways the divide of that Civil War. And for the best part of 100 years, they were like the main, they were the yin and yang, they were the Tweedledum and Tweedledee of the political system. And gradually, in the last 30, 40 years, the capacity of either of those parties to win an overall majority has dwindled and basically disappeared, evaporated. So now they need smaller parties. And that's been true for about 30 years. And as I say, what actually happens then is that the smaller party, no matter how small, if it's big enough to actually make the difference numerically, then it has the power to take over certain areas of policy in which the big parties have no interest whatsoever.
Yeah.
And that's how you get things like migration, because they don't care about that. That's how you get, social welfare policies, all that kind of stuff. So this is kind of what's happened in the last, particularly since 2020, where there was a complete unanimity. I could name with the fingers of one hand the people in the parliament, a total of over 200 people in between the two houses, that who actually have stood up and actually in any way acquitted themselves decently in the last 4 years. The rest have just been nodding donkeys and going along with this great tyranny against the Irish people and the contempt that that Radker and his cronies show for the Irish people. Literally, I almost like to the point of handing out straws and saying, suck it up, suck it up, suck it up. You know, and this is where we are now, you know, that our government, our democracy has been taken away for sure. Like it's I mean, that last week was a really, you know, a bit of a boost, but that was only because they couldn't fix that, you know, because it was a referendum and they couldn't possibly predict what the turnout would be in order to ready up the votes in advance. But I've no doubt that they will be trying to rectify that. They're giving votes now to, in local elections, which we have, to every immigrant who comes into Ireland. So by the time that the Irish people get to the polls, it'll all be over. You know, these are people who don't even know how to spell the name of the country they're in many cases. And this is what's happening. The contempt these people have shown for our country is beyond belief. It is dizzying. It is nauseating. But the Irish people are told, just shut up. And of course, the media, without which none of this will be possible, by the way. I mean, if we had decent, honest media, they would be calling the government out every day, but they're not. And so it remains to be seen now what effect this will have. I don't have any confidence that it's going to put any manners on this government, because they are beyond arrogant, beyond traitorous, beyond beyond redemption, in my view. But at the same time, there is a possibility that in the next election, we have three elections coming up now in the next year, in the next few months, actually, I would say, almost certainly. Well, we know for sure there's the European elections, European Parliament elections, and the local elections are happening in June. And then there's a very strong probability that the general election will take place sometime in the autumn, because it has to happen before this time next year. And, of course, the longer they leave it, the less flexibility and wiggle room they'll have in order, because, you know, events, dear boy, events can take over, and they don't want to do, they don't like events, you know. You know, I think what will be very interesting then is, will something emerge in these elections, which would, if you like, will be a kind of an equivalent to that no box on ballot paper, in the form of independence, perhaps, or in the form of some form of new movement, some actual spontaneous voice of the Irish people. It might well be something that could happen. I hope so, and I feel so as well. I think that this is the moment that it happened before, Peter, you know, back in 2011, when there was the really appalling events that happened in the wake of the economic meltdown, when the troika of the IMF, the World Bank, and the European Commission, three entities, arrived as a kind of a coalition, or a joint policing visitation, shall we say, to basically take possession of Irish economic sovereignty. And that was a great humiliation, a moment of extraordinary sorrow and grief and rage in the Irish people. And that moment, I think if you lit a match in Ireland that time, the whole place would have gone up. But what happened then was a bogus movement started and pretended that it was going to go and lead an alternative movement against these cretins, these cretinous thugs and traitors who are the mainstream parties. And instead, you know, then at the very last minute, they blocked the hallway, as Bob Dylan said, you know, they stood in the doorway, they blocked up the hall, and nobody could go through until the very last moment, when they stepped aside, said they weren't going to run, and ushered in Mr. Enda Kenny, who became possibly the greatest destroyer in Irish history since Oliver Cromwell.
Yeah. No, when I grew up in the 80s with Gareth Fitzgerald and Charles Hawkey, back Fianna Gael, Fianna Fáil, and there did seem to be a choice. And now it seems to be that there isn't really a choice for the voters, and they've come together. Is that a fair assessment of where Ireland are?
100%, Peter. But I think it's very important to, whereas we can go into the whole woke thing, because these parties are now, you know, fixated with woke, contaminated with it. They're saturated with this nonsense and really assiduously pushing it. But I always remind people that none of this is spontaneous, that woke is not a spontaneous, you know, naturalistic movement from the people, or any people. Of course, there are people pushing it, but they're just useful idiots. This is top-down manipulation of an orchestration of our democracies. And it's happening everywhere now, you know, that you know, they have these massive multi-billionaires pumping money into this, into basically destructive political elements, Antifa, the LGBT goons, and so on and so on. Terrorist groups, essentially. Let's not mess around. Like, they're terrorist groups. And using these to batter down the democratic structures of Western countries. That's what's happening. And you see, the people that we are looking at, who are the puppets, you know, they're the quacker watchers, I call them. That's the name for them, actually, the quacker watchers. People who are simply like wooden puppets of the puppet masters. They are just simply there filling space, placeholders. They're indistinguishable. It doesn't matter. I mean, rotating the role of Taoiseach is irrelevant, because essentially you could just have a showroom dummy sitting on the chair for the full 4 years. It doesn't matter who it is, except the only difference it makes is that the quality of the dribble that emerges from the mouths of Martin and Radker is somewhat variegated, in the sense that, you know, Radker is capable of saying the most disgusting things because he has no knowledge of Ireland. He's half Irish. He's an Irish mother and an Indian father. He has no love for Ireland whatsoever. He did a speech there the other day, apparently in America, where he was saying that St. Patrick was a single male immigrant. Nobody, I think, at the meeting where he said it, had the temerity to point out to him that actually St. Patrick was a victim of people traffickers. Mm. And that's exactly what's happening now. And he's their principal ally in the destruction of Ireland.
Well, how does that fit? Because interesting comment about Varadkar's background, his parents Indian. We, of course, here in the UK and England, it's the same with Sunak. And then in Wales, you've just got the new first minister, I think was born in Zambia, I think, Africa. And then, of course, you've got in Scotland and in London, Pakistani heritage. And you kind of look around. And I think my issue is not necessarily that you've got that different background. My issue is the lack of integration and understanding of what it means to be this culture and this community, and a lack of understanding. I think that's where Varadkar seems to have torn up the rule book and what it means to be Irish and wants to rewrite it.
Oh, well, they're actively saying now that really there's no such thing as Irish culture, and that, you know, the people who live in Ireland, whose people have been here for hundreds or maybe thousands of years, that they have no particular claim on this territory. This is something that the great Irish patriot Wolf Tone warned about. You know, he said, you know, this country of ours is no sandbank. It's an ancient land honored into antiquity by its valor, its piety, and its suffering. You know, that's forgotten. These people like Radker don't know the first thing about this and care less. They're like Trudeau in Canada, a completely vacant space, empty-headed, narcissists, egomaniacs, psychopaths. They are traitors. Like, they are really doing things now. I did a stream last week there with somebody in America, in Utah, and I was saying, the headline I put on him was, because I said this, I found myself saying this, that what is happening cannot possibly be happening. And that's really the way all of us feel now, that this is like just something surreal that is beyond comprehension, because it wasn't possible for us to predict that a person could be elected into the office of Taoiseach who would be automatically a traitor, who would have no love for Ireland. It seemed to be axiomatic that in order to get there, you wanted to care. You had to care and love Ireland. These people have no love for Ireland. They are absolutely the enemies of Ireland now.
What about the, obviously you mentioned the two other referendums that happened, in effect on same-sex marriage and life, or the lack of sanctity of life, yes. And those went through. This hasn't. Does that mean there is is it a growing resentment with the government? Is it a growing opposition and desire for conservative values? Where kind of is that coming from? I know it's probably difficult to analyze it because this has just happened a week ago, but what are your thoughts on that?
It's difficult. Because there are different explanations going around. I can only tell you what I believe, and it's based on just observation over a long time. I believe that it is I've been saying, you know, for the last 3 years about Ireland in this context, that the Irishman, Paddy, as he's called, and we don't mind him being called that. You can imagine him sitting in the pub, in beautiful sunny evening, dark, the shadows of the setting sun coming across the bar,
I'm dreaming that. I can have this picture in my mind, John.
And he's got a glass, as we say, a dashing of beer, and he's tipping it away. And then there's a couple of young fellas there and they start missing, pushing around and maybe having a go at some of the women in the bar or whatever, And Paddy will sit there for a long time, and he'll sort of have a disapproving look, but he won't say anything, But there will be a moment, and I call it the kick the chair moment, when he will just reef the chair from under him and he will get up and he'll get one of those guys and have him slapped up against the wall and he will tell him the odds. That's the moment I think we've arrived at, that all of the contempt, all of the hatred, these people go on about hate, introducing hate speech law. There is nobody in Ireland that is more hateful than the government towards its own people. 100%. The most hateful government, I think, in the world at this point. They are abysmal. They're appalling. So this is the moment when I think people took that in. They took it in. We suck it up. Okay. But then one day they said, no more. And that's what happened last Friday week. That's what happened because, you can push people so far. You see, a lot of this has to do with Ireland's kind of inheritance of, post-colonial self-hatred, whereby, they can convince us, that we're white supremacists, even though we have no history of slavery or anything like that, except being slaves ourselves, our ancestors being slaves. But there is, as Frantz Fanon wrote about many years ago, back in the 50s, the pathologies that infect a country that's been colonized are such as to weaken them in a terrible way in the face of the possibility of independence, that they cannot stand up for themselves. And you can see this now. I mean, all over Irish culture now, on magazines, on hoardings, in television advertisements, there's nothing but black faces. Mm. You would swear that Ireland was an African country.
Yeah.
This is part of the gaslighting, that attack that has been mounted against the Irish people. Irish people, you see, genuinely, because they don't understand what's happening, because the word racist is a kind of a spell word, which is used. I call it like a cattle prod, and as soon as you say something, and a big space opens up around you because nobody wants to be near somebody who's a racist, but in fact, we need to begin to understand that these are just words and sticks and stones and so on. But that if we allow this to happen, it means that we will lose our metaphysical home, that our children and our grandchildren will be homeless in the world. That's what's going to happen. Because it's already clear from a lot of these people who are coming in that they're shouting the odds and saying that basically Irish people just better get up and leave their own country because they're not welcome anymore. These are outsiders who've been here a wet weekend. And they're being trained in this. You asked earlier, I forgot to mention this thing. Ireland has something like 35,000 NGOs. 35,000.
Wow.
And these people, in other words, they're non-governmental organizations. What's a non-governmental organization? That's a government which works. That's an organization which works for the government but pretends not to.
Yeah.
This is Ireland is being governed now through non-governmental organizations. And these people are bringing in these foreigners, and they're training them, they're coaching them how to attack the Irish people. How to make a claim on Ireland. Mm. I read an article somebody sent me last week where some guy who came here from Chechnya, and he was saying how great it was that you could come to Ireland and become Irish within hours. Whereas, you could never become Japanese or Chinese, which of course is true. I mean, if I went to Japan, I think it would take about 10,000 years before a relation of mine might be Japanese. And rightly so. Rightly so. There's nothing racist about that. That's just the way things are. That's every country, including the African countries, want to uphold their own ethnicity, integrity, and nationhood. Why the hell can Ireland not do the same? It seems we can't. And our own government is telling us, and our own media is telling us that we can't.
There just some background, there were 160 members in the Dáil of the Irish Parliament, and the government is 80. And I was quite surprised at that, because you talk about a government wanting extra seats to get a bigger majority. But it seems, though, you look who's the opposition, and you've got Sinn Féin, and they are even more captured by the woke agenda than anyone. So you kind of look, and they don't actually... It's kind of the government are rubbing it in people's noses, because they don't actually need a majority or a big majority, because everyone else seems to be fitting into this agenda.
That's a really important point, Peter. It's really important, because you see, what happened in 2020 is really instructive. You know, we had an election in 2020 in February. I actually ran myself, the only time in my life I've ever run for an election, because things were looking so bad. And I didn't, you know, I ran in the worst constituency in Ireland, actually, Dunleary, which is the only constituency which voted yes in this referendum. So that'll just show you how demoralized I was, let's say. But, you know, what happened then was that the government, outgoing government, was basically hammered. Yeah. Radcliffe's government were hammered. And there was a standoff for several months when there was negotiations. And then something happened that was totally, not alone was it, not likely, but each of the parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, in the previous election and for years and decades before that, had said that they would never, ever, ever coalesce with the other. Mm. And then they did. And so for what we had then was from February through until late June of that year, we had Radcliffe running a kind of a caretaker government in the period when the most draconian and radical and unprecedented laws were introduced into Irish society. Nothing like them ever before, the COVID laws. And then in July, Martin took they went into coalition then. And we had Martin, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in coalition doing the same thing, implementing the same policies without question. And anybody who did question, as I did and others, we got hammered and treated like dirt in the courts, in the media, you name it. So, you know, that's the thing, you know, that those parties, they know that no matter what happens, they can rig up the arithmetic. You know, that there's nothing there's nowhere as things stand, unless you get a huge tranche of independents who have the power to nullify whatever power these small parties will have. You know, but you see, one of the factors involved here, now they don't have it this election for the general election where they'll be able to get immigrants and Ukrainians and all these people to vote. But that's probably in a very short order, possibly by the next general election, they will have organized that. And means that increasingly, just as, you know, in terms of the birth rate, Ireland is already being, you know, overtaken. The population is already beginning to be, you know, you can see that the incoming populations is growing at a much faster rate than the Irish population, than the indigenous population, because we have European demographics. You know, we had very briefly, some time ago, surges of after John Paul visited in 79 and so on, we had much higher birth rates than the rest of Europe, but not anymore. And so essentially what we're looking at right across Europe is a replacement of population. And the way you can really know this is that they've decided that the word replacement is a hate word. And when they say that, you know that you're over the target. Because, you know, whenever something becomes dead obvious, they make it quasi-illegal. They make it into a crime.
Yeah, no, I've seen that. Can I ask, it's weird because there's a positive and a negative I see. The negative is that there doesn't seem to be a vocal opposition to what is happening, or a grouping that is standing for family, for the rights of women, a pro-women party. So there doesn't seem to be that on one side, but yet on the other side, the people have rejected what they were told to vote for, not only by the politicians, by every political party, but also by the media. Everything was telling them to do one thing and they've done something else. And yes, I mean, that rebelliousness I love, but I'm wondering, in the middle of that, is there a group, a movement that can appear to begin to stand up? Because Ireland doesn't really have like a populist movement like we're seeing in really every European country except Britain and Ireland. We're left on the sidelines.
Yeah. There, like, really, there was never been, this is ironic given that Edmund Burke was an Irishman, you know, there's been no real conservative party. I mean, they've been called, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil were called conservative parties, but they have no philosophy whatsoever. Like, when Hardy came to Hardy, they switched to the woke side, you know. There's no interesting party that puts forward family-related policies, say, like Viktor Orban does in Hungary or anything like that. It's purely a kind of reactive, opposition. And, you know, that's very, very dismaying because, you know, we desperately need, you see, the big, one of the problems I think here, Peter, is ironically, that is a residual effect of the war against the Catholic Church, which has succeeded in as particularly the clerical abuse scandals, have succeeded in making people very wary of speaking about what you might call Catholic issues, whether that's expressed in family or abortion or whatever. So those issues tend to be leveraged by the leftist liberal parties to actually agitate people so as they actually will go against whatever the church is recommending. And that's been the pattern going right back in the last, certainly in the last decade or so, that was very strong in the referendums. And you see that this is a real problem. Because, you know, if you go on the media in Ireland, if you would be let on on the national broadcaster now, you would be harangued and harassed if you were proposing. Nobody would say, okay, well, what do you got to say? And let's see what you know. And then, okay, well, I don't agree with that, but here's my position. And then that's gone. You're just harangued and you're sneered at, not by necessarily just by the opposition that's in the studio, but by the presenter. Probably foremost among them. That's the way that these things have gone now. And you have all these newspapers campaigning, activists. You know, they purport to be, I guess, in the referendum recently, they purported to be covering it. But in fact, they were fighting for the yes side. And this has been the standard approach. Like, they tell all these lies. I mean, like, there's a very important lie that I want to just call out, which is the Tuam Babies hoax lie, which happened about 10 years ago. Where there was allegations made that 800 babies had been killed by nuns in Tuam and buried in a septic tank. Well, there's been a commission of inquiry that has spent 10 years investigating this, and they have not found one skeleton, one bone of a child in a septic tank. And yet that news has not gone around the world anything like to the extent that the first story went round. And people still out there that I meet think it is absolutely gospel truth that nuns killed 800 children and buried their bodies in a septic tank. That is a complete and utter lie. And they have failed after 10 years of trying. And yet that issue was leveraged in the 2018 referendum to defeat the voice of the church, to nullify what the church was saying on the abortion question, because the implication was, well, they're not really, they don't care about children. You know, this is what goes on in Ireland. It is obscene. It's utterly obscene. And one feels, you know, distraught in the face of it, grief-stricken, to see what has become possible in our beautiful country.
Yeah, well, the media are the virus, and we've seen that time and time again. John, I really do appreciate coming on. When I saw that result, I was so happy, especially seeing the depression on Varadkar's face. That even brought more joy. I'd seen them pull back, and of course, they haven't given up, and they will come back, and I'm sure they will try and mix this type of thing part of their manifesto moving forward. But it is a moment to celebrate, I think, in the pushback. So thanks so much for coming on and sharing it, John.
Thank you very much, Peter. Nice to talk to you.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list, donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.